Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And I'm Richard Dean Winfield.
From the beginning of the creation of a state, even though that's a hefty topic, it's always dealt with the enormous power of nature and the natural world in trying to avoid different scarcities or problems that the natural world might provide. This is extremely relevant, I think, to the state policy today in relation to the pandemic and general crisis that's affecting the economy. And the sad part, or maybe the complex part about that, is that it's something dictated what would, to the human world, be seeming entirely random. But there are other natural occurrences that we will also be going into today. Like climate change, which is boosted and ultimately harmful by humans, created by humans and harmful to humans, overproduction of fossil fuels and plenty of other machinations of our industry are causing horrific effects. And we'll see in unpacking these effects that they're particularly for specific populations. More equatorial populations will start feeling it the first, different coastal populations. But first off, before we get into the self-affected harms of the natural world and humans, Richard, could you describe some of the ways that you see this tragedy of the commons and tragedy of the natural world in relation to the pandemic?
Yeah, I think it's very hard in our current situation not to confront the vulnerability that we as individuals have, that we as a society have, that we as an individual nation has in face of the natural conditions under which we operate. And I've actually had to rethink some of my thoughts on this, not just in face of the circumstances that we're facing in this pandemic crisis and in the looming climate crisis that has been building and building, and we may have kept it out of our horizons in confronting the pandemic, but as we'll see, there is an interrelation between the two, and we can't avoid confronting both. But, you know, I'm engaged in a political campaign, and I'm one of those candidates who is not a darling of any establishment. I'm not rolling in huge amounts of money. I have to instead engage in an activity that I think most of my fellow candidates who are in that situation probably regard as one of the worst parts of campaigning, which is to spend hours doing call time. You literally call up people on lists of donors that you've obtained one way or the other and try to make a pitch. Most of the time, one gets an answering machine. Lately, within the last couple of weeks, in fact, I've been encountering artificial minds in the form of bots that spin out some very peculiar story until I realize that they're repeating it verbatim, and then I know that I'm in the throes of a bot entrapment. But I do encounter real individuals from time to time, and I've had some pretty interesting discussions with some of them. I recently called a retired professor, Martin Hellman, who had been at Stanford University, who is very much involved in sort of rethinking national security, particularly with regard to issues of nuclear weapons and the problems of nuclear proliferation and nuclear disarmament, which is a topic I want us to address at our next podcast. But one thing he stresses is the way in which national security and global security are fundamentally intertwined. You know, we cannot be an island. We are not allowed to be an island. And that applies just as much to health concerns of a pandemic as the health of our biosphere as it's threatened by a climate crisis and as it applies to the way in which we afflict ourselves with the possibility of nuclear annihilation. Now, obviously, a pandemic is a global event. And in some respect, you know, the dangers of a pandemic, I think, have been ignored. And they've been ignored because the last time there was a genuine pandemic in 1918, it was in the middle of a world war. And at least as far as the United States is concerned, there was a certain degree of military censorship that kept the huge toll of the 1918 flu epidemic under wraps and didn't allow it to be disseminated in its full impact and its full scope and the genuinely deadly impact that it had on a whole generation of young people who were the primary victims. Now, of course, we're in a different situation. We're in a situation where the world cannot hide what is going on anywhere. And we also are, in some respect, much more in contact as travelers, as parts of a world market, as parts of an internet, and both in reality and in virtual reality. What happens in one corner of the world is going to have an impact on all parts of the world. Now, this first raging pandemic that in a sense has occurred under these circumstances is something that I think we were unprepared for, partly because we had been lucky, at least in our lifetimes, that when we've had new diseases cropping up for which there was no therapy, no vaccines available, things such as the 2003 SARS COVID virus or the Ebola virus, the outbreaks, as deadly as they were contained. And they did not become pandemics. And if you ask yourself, why did they not become pandemics? Well, partly it was because there was a rapid reaction on the part of both national and international authorities, such as the World Health Organization, which took quick action to slow the transmission and identify who had contracted the disease. And they were able to, in a sense, contain the outbreak as a local epidemic before it could turn into a pandemic. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic also, of course, broke out locally in Wuhan. For a while, the Chinese government was trying to hide what was happening. It silenced some of the primary medical investigators. But the word got out. The World Health Authority was reporting on it not long after it had cropped up. China itself took some very major draconian measures to contain it in Wuhan, but by that time, it had already spread to many, many corners of the world. Trump, for example, will crow about how he had, at a certain point, stopped air traffic from China. But actually, although he was stopping certain kinds of air traffic, he allowed, I believe it's close to 400,000 Americans to travel from China back to the States and allow the contagion to spread. Now, generally speaking, you can see that if we think about the dangers of pandemics, we're dealing with something that is not a one-time event because pandemics are going to, in a sense, be turning up to a greater and more frequent degree owing to several converging circumstances. One is, of course, the globalization of the planet, which has increased contacts of all sorts between every corner of the globe, which means that any outbreak that occurs is going to be very, very difficult to contain in local terms. The other part of it is that there have been several developments that are generating new kinds of health threats, all of which can turn into raging pandemics. One is itself global warming, which we'll be talking about later on in this podcast. And what global warming has been doing is shifting the habitats of different kinds of animals so that they're moving into areas where they had not lived before and coming in contact with people who had not had any kind of contact earlier with them. And that, of course, is also accelerated by the destruction of habitats through the racing deforestation, and that is turning lands into agricultural lands that had previously been wild forests and other types of jungles and the like. And what that has done has led for transmission of diseases between animals and humans to a greater degree than before. And when a disease that is rampant in an animal species jumps into the human species, it can be something for which we have no defenses. And this is also being propagated by this increase in industrial livestock production, which is putting huge numbers of animals in close quarters with one another, creating all sorts of pollution issues, and creating a situation where the possibilities of zoonosis, where transmission between an animal species and human takes place, can occur, and on a mass scale. In addition, as I think many of us know, we are facing another huge health threat that has been, to some degree, ignored. But it is there, very much threatening us, and that is the rise of antibiotic-resistant microbes of all sorts and bacteria. And part of what is accelerating the rise of such resistant organisms is the fact that antibiotics are being dispensed on a mass scale, not only among humans, and to a greater degree also in treating the COVID pandemic, which when you come down with the virus, which weakens your immune system, you're very likely to come down with bacterial infections that have to be treated. So that itself is going to increase the degree of use of antibiotics and the rise of resistant organisms that are mutating, and those that mutate successfully and are resistant are going to be the ones that will predominate. Well, the same thing, of course, is happening in livestock production. Vast amount of antibiotics are being shoved into livestock to protect them and make them fatter than ever. And all of that is going to turn around and bite us very badly, if indeed it leads to all sorts of resistant microbes that can then form a pandemic. Well, I think we can see from what has happened to us that if we're going to have any chance of containing pandemics, be they viral or bacterial, we really have to make an international effort. It's not going to be sufficient to take measures that are simply national in character and think that we can wall off our nation. Even if, for example, we were able to contain a particular disease, provide vaccinations to all our people, establish a certain kind of immunity here, if such a disease is allowed to exist elsewhere, then it can very likely mutate into a form that we will be vulnerable to. So in a sense, I think we can see that we really have to think of international cooperation if we're going to have a possibility of fending off pandemics.
And I think it's really helpful to see actually how the actions that corporations are taking in relation to climate change are directly affecting the pandemic rate. That's something I think that's under-talked about. Definitely in science magazines, people talk about this contact with animals and humans, and also the problem of antibodies eventually, the tech wearing out and not being able to meet the demands of what a very advanced mutating virus could be. But the main concern, I guess, would be out of all this is an actual ability to partner up with other nations in a reasonable diplomatic way for the greater good, because this would be an idea that a UN would support. But most of the time, the UN is not able to get past certain sovereignty blockages. That means that they're not able to make meaningful and powerful alliances with other nations and actually put into practice their policies, because those nations can simply just be the odd people out and claim sovereignty, claim their own control over their own territories, and get out of the deal. We see the best example of this with Trump just saying, well, we're going to pull out of the Paris deal, the Paris climate proposal, which no doubt would have been helpful. But my concern is, even with something like that, say the United States totally picks up on this, what are we to expect out of an international coalition, international body, and how can we help actualize more cooperation, around climate, since it's so broad-reaching, as you've already laid out?
Well, first, I'd like us to go back to the pandemic threat, which obviously has had a huge impact on the health and economic welfare of humanity everywhere on the globe. And I think the problem is not so much that individual nations are going to be resistant to taking advantage of what a global mobilization can offer them, but the absence of such a mobilization. Because you really want to think about where you have to start. And one place we have to start, if we're thinking about these kind of outbreaks, is we first of all have to think about prevention. I mean, one of the big problems we're facing in this pandemic is that we did not engage in preventive measures. And that's particularly true of the United States. It's not just a global problem, but something accentuated in our country, and especially under Trump. In 2018, the U.S. completely shut down its National Security Council Directorate for Global Health Security and Biodefense, which was specifically supposed to be working on preparing pandemic prevention. In that same year, 2018, our government cut 80% of the funding of the CDC for the programs the CDC was having to train workers in outbreak detection and lab and emergency response systems in countries where disease risks are greatest. In 2019, the U.S. cut funding for the so-called PREDICT government research program to identify animal pathogens that might infect humans and thereby prevent pandemics. Now, that's something that really is a primary thing that needs to be funded and supported. Namely, that we, first of all, as one of the primary aspects of prevention, have an international effort to identify the likely causes of new diseases before they have a chance to break out. And that involves dealing largely with zoonosis, which is this process whereby new diseases afflict humanity by coming from animals. That's true now of 75% of new diseases. They originate in animals. And when they jump to humans, we can be in grave problems. So we need to have global research on what are the kind of diseases affecting wild animals and animals with which we have domestic contact, and to see which ones are to be the likely threat and to be prepared. There is a global organization that is concerned with that. It's called the Global Virome Project. But, you know, we need to make sure that this is obviously properly funded. In addition, of course, we see from what happened in the pandemic that we're now afflicted with, that nations around the world were completely unprepared with being able to identify who had come down with the disease. In other words, there was not a sufficient development of testing. And that's a very primary matter that has to be globally provided. We have to have a global organization, a global mobilization of resources to not only produce the tests that are needed for any new disease that is breaking out, but we also have to have the resources mobilized to produce sufficient quantities of the tests and to distribute them around the world so that wherever there is a local outbreak, those who are affected can be as quickly identified as possible, and then contact traced and quarantined. Now, at the same time, you can see that obviously one needs to be able to treat the disease to the extent that it can be. And we've seen, in our case, a total lack of preparation in having supplies of personal protective equipment, having supplies of medical equipment, such as breathing tubes, breathing machines, and the like, all of which were necessary to deal with the outbreak of the disease. Obviously, we have to think of a global mobilization to provide the production of sufficient amounts of these supplies, to have them sufficiently stockpiled, to also have them sufficiently transported. And we can see there's another side to it, which is really going to be crucial if we're going to be able to contain an outbreak. You know, we've seen that when it's too late to isolate the first victims of a disease and contact trace them and clamp down on the transmission, when we have failed to do that and it's spread to a locality and there's enough community transition that it's too late to rely on testing, contact tracing, and quarantining, then we have to engage in the kind of shutdowns of unnecessary activity. But that can be catastrophic for many nations. It can be handled best by nations that are affluent and have the resources to provide replacement income to anyone who's no longer able to work, to provide them with funding so they can pay their rent and stay in homes and so forth, and provide them with medical insurance and the like. But in many countries of the world, such as India, for example, when they had their recent shutdown, it led in a way to real economic peril for hundreds of millions of people who could not get by from day to day unless they could work and have some income. They're not living month to month, they're living day by day. And one of the things that happened in India when they shut down is you had hundreds of millions of migrant workers who are economic refugees from rural areas who come into the cities and work in construction and as domestics and the like. Well, the shutdown occurred and they were not provided any replacement income. They basically had to trudge back to their villages. And what did they do? They spread the pandemic throughout India. Well, if we are going to be able to contend with future outbreaks, the world has to be ready to provide sufficient economic assistance to any nation that has to engage in a shutdown so that it can shut down as needed and yet keep its people solvent, keep its people housed, keep its people fed. And, you know, that is going to be something that is going to be a crucial aspect of any kind of international response.
And we see here at home that there's plenty of shutdowns that have taken place that were only meant to be temporary, but have wound up putting a restaurant or a business incapacitated and unable to recover. And what was supposed to be some early spike and was going to go down due to the negligence of our government has actually exploded in its face. And now we've seen record high numbers. And well, we've already done the shutdown, so are we supposed to do another one? Is sort of the general exacerbations about it.
Yeah, and remember that even if we could accomplish a decent shutdown as needed and then reopen when ready and have the contact tracing and the like, we're going to remain in jeopardy unless the pandemic can be controlled throughout the world, because we can't not remain isolated from the rest of the world. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that it's been recognized that environmental degradation and human activity that is causing a climate emergency has played a role in generating pandemics. I mentioned that, you know, one of the key things is that it's putting us into contact with all sorts of animals who've had to change their territories, or alternately, who now find humans invading their territories. And as I mentioned, 75% of new diseases have to do with this animal-to-human transmission. And the UN has reported that if you look at the causes of emerging diseases that threaten future pandemics, it has to do with changing use of land. It has to do with changes in agriculture. It has to do, to some degree, with international travel. But it also has to do, in a sense, with the degradation of the environment and climate change. And for that reason, if we're going to think about containing the pandemic, we also have to recognize that it's going to have to involve working on preventing environmental degradation and the kind of accelerating human activities that are causing these great changes in what diseases we find ourselves being contained to. Now, this idea of animal to human transmission being crucial is something recognized in China. On February 24th of this year, China announced a permanent ban on wildlife trade and consumption, with a few exceptions. And we've heard about these so-called wet markets, which are being banned as well. Now, you might ask, what does a wet market refer to? It really refers to markets where animals, often wild species, exotic animals and the like, are being sold primarily for consumption, for human consumption. And one of the reasons you have such markets is that in many parts of the world, people don't have refrigeration. So if they're going to buy edible livestock, they're going to be buying the live animals and be in contact with them and the sort. So obviously one has to deal with that in thinking about how we get beyond those kind of issues. But clearly, if we're going to engage in global disease control, we have to engage in prevention. Prevention which involves, on the one hand, identifying the kind of pathogens that are to be found in the animal world that may be transmitted to humans in the future, dealing with the kind of changes in agricultural production and how we're dealing with our climate and environment, and of course, mobilizing the world and not turning our backs on the World Health Organization, but helping it to have as many resources as needed, to have ready everything that will be needed to deal with any future outbreaks. But that means we have to take into account something that has been pushed into the background that is not going to recede in a way in which this pandemic may recede, hopefully within a year, maybe 2 years. But we are facing a climate crisis that is not going to recede in a matter of years. We're dealing with something that can be tormenting us for thousands, if not tens of thousands of years to come.
And one way of looking at the problems of the climate crisis and emergency that we have is its multifaceted effects, its ripples, and a bunch of different policy issues. For example, one would be this notion of habitat change in ecology. But despite migration, there's also immigration problems with humans as well that will start to arise. People are going to have to flee these extremely hot climates that become uninhabitable, unfarmable. They're going to have to move. There's other, a multitude of different effects that this has across economic concerns. If we're going to take seriously this climate crisis, we have to look at what kind of industry we're going to be investing in. But before we get into all that, can you talk a little bit about the industry that is currently suppressing this stark and scary information about the climate emergency, because there certainly seems to be money at play.
Yeah. I mean, views on our climate crisis, views on what might properly be called not global warming, but global heating. There's a really stark disparity in views. If you look at what intelligence and defense establishments have to say in the United States and elsewhere, and what certain industry groups and politicians of a certain bent and media are saying on the other. The United States intelligence and defense services all consider climate change to be our number one security risk. And they're our number one security risk not simply because of the huge threat that this climate emergency poses to our own economic well-being, but it rather poses a threat to huge dislocations in the fabric of life abroad and throughout the world that is going to lead to all sorts of conflicts that are going to make peace a matter of really a kind of elusive character because of all the tremendous tensions that are going to be facing areas of the world. Now, by contrast, in the two countries that have contributed most to greenhouse gases and to other aspects of the degradation of the environment that are bringing climate changes that are truly threatening humanity, we have on the one hand the granddaddy of greenhouse gas production, the United States, and then the new number one in greenhouse gas emissions, which is China. Now, both in the United States and China, the people at large are, in some respect, least concerned. Now, in a way, they're least concerned because both nations have, in a way, benefited hugely from cheap fossil fuel energy. That's one thing. And of course, that has been decisive in China, which has brought more people out of poverty than anywhere in human history in recent decades, thanks to a huge industrial expansion that has been fueled by a huge increase in energy production and energy production that is primarily fossil fuel generated. And in both societies, there have been important sectors of the government and industry that have, needless to say, been minimizing the risk. And the United States is none other than the fossil fuel industry itself, which has been doing very much what the tobacco industry did to try to label, in effect, as fake news, all the scientific research that had been showing that tobacco and smoking in general was a major cause of cancer and heart disease. Well, today, the fossil fuel industry has had massive misinformation campaigns. Much of them have been supported by the billionaire oligarchs, the Koch brothers. And of course, they've had much support from Rupert Murdoch and his control of Fox News and much of the Republican Party, which has operated as a climate change denier. And as a result, you know, our population in the United States has been very reluctant to wake up to the threat, let alone to see what challenges we face in trying to avoid it. So you know, they want to claim, for example, that there is a legitimate scientific controversy over whether human activity has caused a global heating that is threatening vast changes on the planet that are going to cause immense harm, when that is not the case. There is a gigantic scientific consensus which relies on indisputable evidence showing how there's a very strict convergence in the warming of the planet with the increase in fossil fuel generated greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere.
Right. I was merely going to say they've done a masterful rhetoric blinding where they've made the question three parts, more like, do you believe the globe is heating up? And do you the main question would be, do you believe humans are causing the global warming or the global heating, as you like to say? And this is a really tricky way of pigeonholing the question into sort of just a non-existent issue in the scientific community. I mean, they've totally turned it into just a point of debate. And, you know, to flesh it out, there's plenty of evidence, but it sort of, it can wash over people, but can you maybe bring some important nodes on the laundry list of proof for the reason why climate change is created, is influenced by human activity?
Well, the basic proof consists in records and research that has shown, first of all, on the one hand, there are certain gases that operate as greenhouse gases. That is, they allow sunlight to go through them, but they prevent infrared radiation from passing through them in return. And thereby, they will lead, as in a greenhouse, to a heating of the planet, unless there are countervailing tendencies of a different sort. And there has been documented a clear increase in the temperature of the planet with the growth of industrialization and the production of greenhouse gases, primarily through fossil fuels. And greenhouse emissions in total come 72% from fossil fuel, which produces CO2. They come 19% from methane, which is not combusted, as natural gas will produce CO2 when it's burned. We're talking about methane that's released from certain kinds of natural gas production efforts, from livestock, from, in some respect, the melting of permafrost. But methane is a very, very active greenhouse gas that is more powerful in its effects than CO2. There's also 6% of greenhouse gas emissions are from nitrous oxide produced by agriculture, in particular the use of fertilizers in agriculture. And then 3% has to do with fluorinated gases, some of which have been removed from production in an international effort that was successful in protecting our ozone layer. But nevertheless, that is those are the kind of emissions that are having an effect on climate change. And, you know, you might say, well, let the Earth heat up. It's going to have some effects that are good, some effects that are bad. It, of course, depends where you are. After all, if we're talking about Canada and Siberia, you might have the idea that, well, with global warming, these today relatively uninhabited portions of the Earth have the potential to become the new breadbaskets, the new agricultural utopias of humanity in the coming 100 years. Now, of course, there is a warming that is going to transform to some degree the habitability of large parts of the Earth. But first of all, these regions are not yet developed. It's not as if one can immediately start making use of them in a productive way and have vast migrations of people to them. Another similar thought is that, well, you know, eventually we're going to be slipping into an ice age, which is going to cool things down. But it turns out that global warming has already pushed off the next ice age, which might come for another 100,000 years. It's worth noting that 20,000 years ago, the last ice age came. You know, we had immense ice caps that came down from the northern regions of the planet and advanced from the South Pole as well. I grew up on Long Island, which basically is a moraine. That is, it's just a heap of rubble that was left by the retreating glaciers as they melted. You know, they had swept off all of this material, rocky material, from the Earth as they pushed southward. And then when they retreated, they left such things as Long Island. But one thing to keep in mind regarding something that we have to face up to, which is the question of sea levels. At the height of the last glacier, 20,000 years ago, the sea levels were more than 400 feet lower than they are today. And the sea levels have risen since the glaciers, the last glacier age, the last ice age, they've risen over 400 feet. And for the last 2,500 years, they were pretty stable. But then things started changing. things started changing, and a lot of things have been changing. And a lot of things are changing in a way where anyone who looks at the future in through rosy glasses and imagines how Siberia and Antarctica and Northern Canada are going to become cornucopias of agricultural production and temperate living. There's something else that lurks in the background. And that's the possibility that the planet Earth turn into a hothouse, turn into something like its perhaps twin planet in our solar system, Venus, in which a runaway greenhouse gas emissions produced a surface that's completely unlivable. Now, I think it's worth surveying what are the effects that are happening now and are going to intensify. You know, the land surface of the Earth has, as a whole, increased in temperature by, now what is estimated to be about 2 degrees centigrade, or almost 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And that is enough to already produce significant heat waves that have led to massive deaths. It's led to a significant increase in wildfires. It's leading to a significant increase in desert expansion throughout Northern Africa, in parts of Latin America, in parts of Asia. And that has been accompanied with more and more droughts. Now with the heating, that involves increasing evaporation of water. And that causes more intense storms that are damaging agriculture and infrastructure through extremely wet and dry monsoon events with increased rainfall and hurricanes and typhoons that have increasing wind speeds. You know, these are already happening in ways that are causing significant damage. And then on top of that, you have the extinction and relocation of species, including insects, that are pushing various diseases out of tropical zones into what were formerly temperate zones, such as dengue, malaria, and then also pandemics caused by contact between humans and animals. And all of these things are exacerbated by the deteriorating health condition of many, many humans on the planet who are suffering malnutrition due to crop failures caused by excessive heat and dryness. And then we have to think about the sea level rise that is occurring. And that is inundating low-lying coasts already, particularly deltas, some of which are very important for agriculture. And it's also leading to ocean acidification because the increased CO2 gets involved in chemical reactions with the ocean, producing greater acidity that is destroying coral reefs, which are important habitats of all sorts of sea life, and damaging certain kinds of sea life. So we're here really dealing with a whole complex of developments that are estimated to put 183 million people in risk of famine in the coming decade. And the food insecurity that has already been produced by climate change is already affecting large regions in South America, Asia, and Africa. And just by 2030, in 10 years from now, the World Bank estimates that global warming is going to drive 120 million people into poverty. And one thing that is important to recognize is that the way in which the effects of global heating are operating is that they're really going to increase global inequities and global inequality. Because the regions that have been least responsible for greenhouse gas emissions are the ones who are going to suffer the most. And I'm talking about sub-Saharan Africa, much of Central America and Latin America, and South Asia and Southeast Asia.
So, I mean, not to be lighthearted about such a dark situation, people are not going to be eaten by the second coming of the Ice Age saber-toothed tigers, but they'll die from much more stark human causes. things like overproduction and agriculture are just making this even worse. It's interesting to hear these stats about the agriculture industry being one of the main culprits of it. Our very food is actually, and its mass production is the thing that's partially causing a demise. But to think about where this is coming from, specifically around agriculture, people have taken different steps, like vegetarianism or veganism. Something like this seems to be a weird but simple solution. But there's obviously, I'm a vegetarian myself, but there's obviously more important things to focus on, like stronger mitigation efforts. And I was wondering if you could get into maybe less personal solutions, like reduce, reuse, recycle, things like that, that certain people champion as the end-all, be-all to the change they want to see when it comes to climate change. I'm talking about real mitigation efforts, stuff that, like cleaning rivers and maybe uptaking dirty air, for lack of a better word. Could you go into some of maybe the policy efforts that could be put forward in this Green New Deal or something like it?
I mean, I think, first of all, we really have to take note of the genuine urgency of the problem. Because it's not only that there are going to be very, very significant harms that put the livelihood and life of large numbers of humanity in jeopardy, but we really can think of scenarios where everything gets out of control and makes the planet uninhabitable. And part of this is because there are all sorts of feedback mechanisms that we are going to be facing. For example, the increased water vapor that's produced by global warming acts as a greenhouse gas and intensifies warming and produces more water vapor in the atmosphere and thereby increases further heating. The same thing applies to what's called the albedo, the ice albedo feedback mechanism. And that is when territories that are covered by ice melt. What's left exposed is no longer reflecting sunlight. It's not white like ice or snow. It's going to be absorbing radiation and heating. And that's going to cause further heating, further melting of ice, and leading to further albedo effects. And in addition, one has to really worry about the permafrost, which covers huge territories of northern Canada and Siberia, vast parts of the Earth. Because when the permafrost melts, not only is there this albedo feedback of more territory that is now darker than before and absorbing more radiation, infrared radiation, and heating up even further, but it's going to release large amounts of methane. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. And it's very possible that we're going to reach a tipping point. A tipping point in which all of the ice caps in the world are going to be melted. Now, already we have the glaciers in places like the Himalayas and many other parts of the world are significantly getting depleted. And these are all major sources of rivers that are the basis of agriculture. And of course, also fishing and the like for large parts of the world's population. But then also we have to worry about the melting of the ice caps on Greenland and Antarctica. Already, the rising of sea levels, 15% of that rise in the last decade is being caused from runoff from Greenland. And we may have reached a tipping point where the entire ice cap on Greenland is going to slip, well, slip into the ocean and melt. And if that happens, if all the ice on Greenland were to melt, sea levels are going to rise 24 feet. That's 7.4 meters. 24 feet. Well, it turns out that large, large numbers of people live on coastlines that are less than 10 meters above sea level. In fact, 10% of the world population lives in such coastal regions. Two-thirds of the world's cities, with over 5 million people, are lying in these low-lying coastal areas. We're talking about 600 million people living directly on the coast. And needless to say, when the water is increasing, reaching up coastlines, it increases the saline composition of rivers that they're encroaching on. And this is now already threatening agriculture in the Nile Delta, in the Red River Delta of China, in the Mekong Delta of Vietnam, and in much of Bangladesh. Cities like Miami, Rio de Janeiro, Osaka, Shanghai, New York are really facing a direct threat. Islands like the Maldives and Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands are literally facing being completely submerged. And Indonesia is now planning to relocate its capital from Jakarta, because Jakarta is sinking and it can't really be protected. And if we are unable to stop the increase in the rise of temperature and these feedback mechanisms go into play, then we face the prospect of the ice cap and Antarctica falling into the sea. And if that happens, then we're talking about sea levels rising 58.3 meters. That's 191 feet. Well, that is going to involve massive, massive relocations. Now, obviously, we're dealing with problems that already have been causing a lot of havoc in the world. Many people think that the Arab Spring was caused by all of the economic dislocations of increasing desertification in North Africa and the Middle East. There's a huge amount of migration from Central America and from North Africa and from Southeast Asia that is due to people who can no longer earn a livelihood because their areas are becoming more full of salt or they're being submerged. We're dealing with a situation where we need to have international efforts. It's not a matter of making personal decisions. Now, it's worth thinking about what has happened so far and how inadequate the international efforts so far have been.
I think for a lot of people, especially in the cultural environment today, it's easier to imagine sort of this horrific ending of the world than an actually stabilized cooperative effort. We can see how difficult it's become and how politicized mere existential problems are, just living, reinforcing the fact that this is something that you talk about in sort of a general international politics class. You'll say, well, which rights are the most primary? And there's often a debate that ensues. But one that I think, I mean, just to reinforce what you were talking about at the beginning, is really security. I mean, you have to be able to walk out of your, you need to be able to live primarily. And that's what's at stake with something like this. So sort of patsy footing a real agreement about this is not in the cards anymore. And especially for somebody that's my age, this is maybe one of the most radicalizing things, because people wake up and realize there might not be a tomorrow to wake up to. And it's really sad. It's hard to see how this is a controversial topic in general, and it no longer needs to be. And I'm just hoping you can maybe show some of the ways that we can reach a better agreement about this stuff. Yeah. And it doesn't seem too difficult, but maybe you'll have some suggestions.
Now, there have been a series of international agreements that have tried to deal with this climate crisis. You had the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, where there were actually legally binding commitments for those who signed on. But the United States withdrew from the extension of the Kyoto Protocol in 2012. Bush claimed that it exempted 80% of the world, including China and India, from compliance and would cause serious harm to the United States. And part of what some of these agreements have done is to recognize the different kind of concerns that have to be met by efforts to mitigate climate change. You had a 1992 United Nations Framework Convention in Climate Change, the UNFCCC. And what it attempted to do was set up this regime where, on the one hand, it would require greenhouse gases to be stabilized at levels where the world ecosystems could naturally adapt to the climate change that would occur, and it would not push beyond that limit, that food production would not be threatened, and that economic development can be sustained. Obviously, there's a huge concern, particularly in nations like China and India, that they be able to bring the large numbers of people in both countries that have been living in poverty to a reasonable standard of living, which requires producing much more energy. And both India and China have indeed been developing a lot of renewable energy, but they have also been developing vast numbers of coal production plants. Now, to some degree, there was a sense that developing nations have to be given some kind of leeway so they can increase their energy production. But we're facing a situation where today the United States produces 15% of global emissions, greenhouse gases. You know, we're 4% of the population. If we were to cut off entirely our net greenhouse gas emissions, this obviously is important, and it's a name that we should have in terms of a domestic Green New Deal. But that leaves 85% of the world's greenhouse emissions untouched. We have to think of an international Green New Deal. Now, that has not been affected by the Kyoto Protocol or the 2015 Paris Agreement, which tried to keep climate change below any further heating of 2 degrees Celsius, and ultimately to keep it below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which it would hope would prevent complete destabilizing of the Greenland ice sheets and worse effects of desertification and intense storm activity and even Antarctica losing its ice shelf. As we know, Trump is threatening to remove the U.S. from the Paris Agreement in 2020. But the Paris Agreement is not enough. Now, I myself had been drawn to the idea of a Green New Deal where we would aim by 2030 in the United States to achieve 100% renewable energy. And to me, that meant that we would have to basically lower the boom on the fossil fuel industry and tell the fossil fuel industry, you have to reinvent yourself. As of 2030, no longer will any fossil fuels be extracted. We have to end fossil fuel exploration. We have to stop the production of vehicles and appliances that can only use fossil fuels. We have to ensure that when you go to a gas station, all that will be available will either be electric charging stations, hydrogen, or biofuels. And it seemed that in a sense one could go to 100% renewable energy by relying on biofuels and using wind and solar and a certain amount of battery backup. Now, I myself was skeptical of writing off nuclear energy. We've seen very pernicious things happening in Germany and Japan, both of whom decided to get rid of their nuclear power industry. And what has happened in both is that in order to make up for the power production that nuclear energy had been providing, they are now building large numbers of coal-fired plants that are completely removing any kind of benefits of the moves that these nations have been making towards green energy. Now, I have to say that there has been a certain skepticism of being able to move to purely renewable energy. And I don't know Chris, if you saw the Michael Moore produced film, Planet of the Humans, that actually was done by Jeff Gibbs.
Right.
It was released in 2019. It's available for streaming. And he was a climate change activist, an activist for a Green New Deal, but he became skeptical of the feasibility of 100% green energy. And if you watch the film, it attempts to show that it's really not possible to provide us with the energy we need by relying on solar arrays, wind energy, or biofuels. that it's not really practical. Now, he leaves out of account nuclear energy entirely. And some people, of course, have questioned his results, but something similar came out of a report in Minnesota, which investigated to what degree renewable energy with battery storage could supply the needs of areas like Minnesota that often are covered by clouds, often do not have sufficient wind. And it became clear that renewable energy could at most supply 70%. There was this big gap that had to be dealt with. And, you know, I myself felt, well, we could think about retaining nuclear energy, at least in the short term. And then I had a call doing call time and spoke to someone who was an engineer of sorts, who spoke to me about what are called fourth generation nuclear reactors. That is, there is actually a convention, an international convention of the Generation 4 International Forum that includes Australia, Canada, China, France, Japan, Russia, South Africa, South Korea, Switzerland, the UK, and the United States, that are working to develop a new type of design of nuclear reactors that would overcome much of the problems of previous nuclear reactors. And of course, we have, you could say, three big problems in nuclear energy production has presented. One is the danger of nuclear proliferation, that nuclear power plants produce wastes that can be used to produce nuclear weapons. The second is that they produce wastes that we don't know what to do with, and that they have half-lives of 100,000 years or more. And then thirdly, there's a danger of a meltdown, of which we've seen a few examples, Chernobyl being the worst of all, which do not produce an atomic explosion, but they do produce explosions that throw off large amounts of radioactive material over a large territory that can become uninhabitable for centuries to come. Well, the fourth generation nuclear power plants are designed in such a way that, first of all, they have a kind of passive safety mechanism, a kind of fail-safe mechanism, where if there's any kind of overheating of the reactor, it automatically slows down the chain reaction by simply having the fuel expand. And you don't have these pressurized reactors that require water to be pushed through them to cool things down, that require energy sources, which are very vulnerable to things like earthquakes or storms, tsunamis, or anything that would alter the supply of power. Instead, we have these passive designs where any kind of overheating automatically involves, through the force of gravity, nothing other than a shutdown of further nuclear fission. They also have the characteristic that some of them can actually run on the spent fuel waste that we have all over the planet, wherever there are nuclear reactors, and have no idea what to do with. So in a sense, they provide a means of getting rid of all of that. And they, in a way, have a kind of renewable character that many of them can not only, let's say, use up all of these wastes, but they can also operate as a kind of breeder reactor that produces more usable fuel than they produce. But the fuel is not usable for nuclear proliferation because it's not using uranium, it's using other kinds of radioactive material like thorium. So in this way, you have the possibility in the short term, and there are working models that have now gone into production, of having a kind of nuclear power that could be used safely, that could be make up the gap that renewable energy presents us with, and it would be relatively safe and practical and things that we can implement in the near future. So in this sense, if we want to make a transition, we can make the transition by retaining an element of nuclear power that would allow us to solve the problem we have to solve of what to do with nuclear waste, not be susceptible to nuclear proliferation, and have a kind of fail-safe design. Of course, another more long-term solution is fusion power. It doesn't appear that fusion power is going to be workable by 2030, maybe not by 2050, but clearly it's something we have to think about, having global kinds of investments. But there's one other solution that I came upon again through another QualTime call, where I was speaking with Richard Parenteau, a biologist, who was speaking to me about a technology called methane pyrolysis. And this is a way in which natural gas, which currently is cheap and plentiful, can be made use of in a process that removes all of the carbon from it. And methane, which is basically what natural gas is composed, each molecule of methane is one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms. Well, you have this process where you push the methane gas, or natural gas, through a molten metal catalyst, which completely strips all the hydrogen atoms. And what you're left with is carbon on the one hand, and then hydrogen. And then you can burn the hydrogen, which is very efficient as a source of energy. And of course, when you oxidize or burn hydrogen, you get water. In other words, you get no byproduct that is going to be a problem in terms of global warming. So here you have a way that already you have practical demonstration projects available that have shown it's worked, that it can work, and that it's, that's 100% efficient, where we can use natural gas in a way that will not add any CO2 to our atmosphere. And it will leave as a byproduct nothing but water and nothing but carbon, which sells for $75 a ton. Of course, you can make diamonds of it if you so choose. But basically, here we have a way in which we can actually produce electricity that is completely neutral with regard to the production of greenhouse gases. That is also much cheaper than solar currently. And that's of crucial importance for countries like China and India and many nations in Africa and Southeast Asia, which frankly cannot afford huge expenditures in solar or wind energy, but could afford making use of natural gas. So in this sense, if we want to think of an international Green New Deal, we can think of mobilizing on an international scale investments in these technologies, in methane pyrolysis, in generation four nuclear reactors, continue massive investment in solar energy, in wind energy, potentially in wave energy, and also in biofuels, and develop biofuels in a way where we're not cutting into the agricultural production of food. And we could then really move on a world scale to shutting down any net increase in greenhouse gases, which is the key measure that has to be taken if we are going to avert a climate catastrophe. Now, I think if you look upon this on a global scale, this really requires an international effort, where clearly the nations who are most affluent have to make use of their greater resources to enable other nations to take advantage of these technologies. And for those who are producing fossil fuels that cannot be clean, and here I'm talking about petroleum and coal, we have to enable them to shut down those industries, shut down any further exploration for coal or petroleum, leaving aside natural gas, and enable these nations to reinvent themselves. And, you know, when you think about the Green New Deal, either domestically or internationally, on the one hand, you have the green side of it, a green side of it which can involve renewable energy. It can also involve making use of what natural gas is left through technologies like methane pyrolysis, if it can be shown to really be effective. And then a certain degree, as I mentioned, of nuclear energy, both fission and fusion. But there's the other side, which is the New Deal side of both a domestic and international New Deal. And we have to address that as well.
Right. Instead of all the new possibilities of this. I mean, first of all, this is very exciting and ironic that it does come from these sort of dreaded phone calls of being on the campaign. Yeah. But, you know, I guess there's the silver linings to those too now. But it's also important to know that all this stuff doesn't just go to blockchain, for example, or just doesn't go to one industry that can then just beef up their own production capabilities and weird mixed economy of mixed fuel economy and nuclear power economy leaves people in further smaller economies in further shambles than they already are, because there definitely could be a stratification of this as well. At least that's the first fear that comes to mind. So you're getting at this, I assume, is this is the New Deal aspect. It needs to be jobs that put power back into the hands of the workers, and so that they're able to actualize their freedom with these new technologies, and securing that is up to the state and is the role of the state to implement these kind of policies. It's in their control to democratize this possibly wonderful new source of power.
Now it is, as you mentioned, something that a state can do, at least within its territory, to the extent that it has sufficient resources. But we're here really dealing with an international problem.
Right.
And the ramifications are very, very unequal. You know, we've seen that the damage that is being done by global heating and sea level rise and so forth is predominantly affecting nations that have less resources. And by the way, you know, we're really facing a crisis where currently 1% of the Earth's surface is too hot to live on. But very soon, it's going to be 19% of the world's surface is going to be too hot to live on. And that includes major sections of highly populated regions of South Asia, of Africa, of East Asia, of Latin America. And we have to think about how, on the one hand, we have to enable all nations to be able to get the energy resources they need in a way that does not add to greenhouse gases, and that anyone whose livelihood depended upon the fossil fuel industries that were producing global warming, we have to ensure that they have alternate forms of employment. The other side of it, you know, it's been pointed out that those nations that are major importers of fossil fuels, they're going to be benefiting from developing green energy because they don't have to pay for that imports. Whereas those who were exporting such things, they're going to be facing more difficulties because they're going to be stuck with this unusable infrastructure and all of the things that depended upon it. So we're really requiring a real global effort in which the United States, as the world's largest economy, most powerful military nation, and biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in history, has a responsibility to take a leading role. And that requires that we really think of having a deadline, a worldwide deadline, for shutting down any net increase in greenhouse gases. And we should think domestically of doing it by 2030. And I think that is completely feasible. And we should think of doing it worldwide, if not by 2030, as soon as we can, and hopefully no later than 2050, at which point these really cumulative effects, these really feedback effects are going to be going out of hand. And this is something that requires not walking away from these very feeble agreements that have been made, but joining together into agreements that are stronger and that obviously are going to be the benefit to everyone. I mean, our security is intimately tied to global security, and that applies to every nation on the world. That applies both to pandemics, and it equally applies to the climate crisis, which could make life uninhabitable. I'm sorry, could make the planet uninhabitable for intelligent life, and could at the very least put a huge toll on humanity as it finds itself afflicted by its own profligate use of fossil fuels. You know, the time to act is now. And I'm afraid The coming elections are a time of reckoning for how we in the United States are going to deal with this climate crisis.
To all those humans who cannot live on Venus, unite.
All right. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have never heard this, the new energy ideas before. Very exciting for this. But also, you're right. We need to focus on the election and the near term.
I will say this, that, you know, I am not a chemist. I'm not a nuclear engineer. So I'm not in a position to say with any great expertise how readily available, how feasible methane pyrolysis and fourth generation nuclear reactors are. But there is a literature about them. And there are those who certainly think that they are viable. And I think that they deserve our consideration. And that requires us to rethink what the Green New Deal will be, and also how feasible the Green New Deal can be, both at home and abroad.